On the eve of the 2007 federal election, people looked hopefully towards an end to the vile era of Howard rule, and rightly so. And it wasn't so much that those who had voted for Rudd had massive expectations of Labor, but rather that thousands of workers and left-wing people who'd demonstrated against, you know, some of us will have the experience of having thrown socks at the TV every time Howard came up or whatever, actually took a stand against Howard, were looking forward to relegating him to the past. And it was this sentiment that Rudd was appealing to when at the Labor Party's conference in April 2007, he announced, "The election in just a few months will be about the future versus the past." Now, obviously, the election was going to be in the future, but that's, you know, pretty much where, you know, where this kind of statement, you know, actually stopped being true. Because Rudd and Gillard then spent the following 7 months bending over backwards to dampen down expectations that a future Labor government would be introducing any radical changes. And if we cast our minds back to that period, we can recall Rudd constantly reassuring big business that he was in fact no socialist but an economic conservative, thanks for that reminder, distancing himself from the trade union movement and declaring himself a proud supporter of the US-Australia alliance. And Gillard, that shining star of the Labor left, was no less willing to prove her intentions to do the boss's bidding by pledging to police construction workers and actually praising the Hawke and Keating governments that had helped, in her words, kickstart a new era of rising productivity and profitability for Australian capitalism. She even spoke of the decline in union membership under Hawke and Keating as an achievement. And so during that reform period, she crowed to the Melbourne Press Club, "The decline in trade union membership levels averaged 5% per year, compared to an annual average fall of 2% under the Howard government." And at this point, you would have had your head stuck pretty far in the sand, or, you know, something else more rude than that, to think that a leadership that wanted to criticise Howard for not kicking unions enough was going to represent a break with the past. But despite Rudd's efforts to position Labor to the right in the election campaign, it was inevitable that Howard's demise would create expectations for change in Australian politics, and not only with regards to the hated industrial relations laws. For ordinary workers and students everywhere who had lived through more than a decade of anti-union, racist, warmongering, neoliberal government policies, Howard's defeat was like, you know, a breath of fresh air, a sigh of relief, and it seemed as if things could only improve. And, you know, lots of people felt better about the world. Left-wing people who thought, you know, everyone else in Australia is pretty, you know, hopelessly right-wing, had their faith in humanity restored. The elections also reflected the shift towards left-wing attitudes that has been taking place in Australian society since the 1990s. And for many years, surveys have now shown a consistent shift to the left on issue after issue. Growing opposition, for instance, to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, hostility to big business and the huge payouts to company executives, hatred of work choices, a growth in pro-union sentiment, support for more spending on health and education, you know, more support for refugees and gay marriage and so on and so on. But if Rudd's victory raised any hopes for change, the reality is that over the past 15 months of a Rudd government, Labor has proven itself just as determined as Howard, to rule for the big end of town. And let's have a brief look at exactly how they've proven this to us. Well, for a start, Rudd has withdrawn some combat troops from Iraq, but has consistently championed US imperialism. Not only was his first state visit to Washington in order to proclaim support for the war criminal Bush and to express his hopes that whatever the results of the next presidential election, that there would be, in his words, no retreat of America from the world, but he was also quick to assert his long-term commitment to fighting the war on Afghanistan. And just last month, despite a news poll which indicated that, you know, two-thirds of Australians actually opposed sending more Australian troops to Afghanistan, Rudd has refused consistently to rule out a further troop deployment and has justified this by urging us to always remember that the war in Afghanistan is the good war, that, you know, we're fighting supposedly against terrorism and all of those sorts of things. And Labor's support for US imperialism has also extended to the unquestioned support for the US proxy state in the Middle East of Israel. And during Israel's brutal war on Gaza earlier this year, Gillard refused to condemn Israel's bloody assault, which saw over 1,400 Palestinians murdered. To move to another issue, Rudd's apology to the Stolen Generations was an important victory for all of the Indigenous people and their supporters like us, who have for decades stood up against the racist Australian establishment. Yet Rudd has continued the racist Northern Territory intervention, which signifies the theft of Aboriginal land, the further impoverishment of Indigenous communities, and lays the basis for another Stolen Generation. And most recent government plans, they're published in our magazine, actually indicate that public housing will not be built in Indigenous communities unless they agree to cede control of their land to the government, you know, for at least 40 years. On the question of gay and lesbian rights, there's been the abolition of some homophobic statutes and provisions, yet Rudd has refused, patently refused, to grant gay marriage rights, and in so doing, actually eliminate all vestiges of discrimination from the law. Opposition to work choices was the key factor in Howard's defeat in the 2007 elections. With the IR law so despised by the mass of the working class, Labor's voting base, there was a lot of speculation, in particular by the trade union officialdom, that Rudd's Labor would signal the end of the anti-union laws. Speaking at the Labor Party conference in 2007, electrical trades union official Dean Mile had this to say about a future Labor government. A Labor government would give unions the power to coerce employers into agreements restoring our conditions. It's going to be fun. A bevy of other union leaders echoed the refrain that electing Labor was the solution to the work choices nightmare. The head of the ACTU, the Australian Council of Trade Unions, Sharon Burrow, wrote an article for the October 2007 edition of the New South Wales Nurses Association Bulletin, in which she predicted that under Rudd, Labor, working families will help with get help with education costs, better health services, and no work choices. And over a year since, it's been the Labor Party's commitment to keeping most of the anti-union laws that has most starkly indicated the continuity between the Howard and Rudd governments and Rudd's, you know, perennial alliance, complete alliance with the bosses. Despite repeated claims that Labor stood for working families, if we sort of remember all of the rhetoric of the 2007 election campaign, before the election, Gillard spent months lunching with business leaders and schmoozing with corporate fat cats. Shortly after Mile made the comment that I read out earlier, he was very publicly kicked out of the ALP as Rudd made it clear that there'd be no tolerance for unions who challenged employers. And he said, "I'm not going to have trade union officials regarding it as fun running around the place intimidating employers." I mean, it sounds like fun to me, but you can understand why Rudd wasn't going to have a bar of it. In fact, it was at that very Labor Party conference that Miles spoke at that the Labor Party unveiled the Work Choices Light policy it would be taking to the federal election. Policy that made virtually all strike action illegal and maintained the draconian force to police building industry workers, the ABCC. And since the elections, other than the abolition of any new Australian workplace agreements, which Gillard announced with much fanfare in the press, it's been much more of the same union bashing from Gillard and Rudd, who've taken every, just absolutely every opportunity to crap on about the need to discipline union thugs. In the current context of economic crisis and global recession, we can only expect that Rudd will ramp up attacks on workers. Up until now, Rudd has offered a stimulus package with cash bonuses for workers and spending on schools and other essential infrastructure that, you know, was unsurprisingly welcomed by people struggling to make ends meet. But the stimulus package is woefully inadequate and will do nothing to seriously offset the impact of the crisis. Upon announcing the stimulus package, Rudd actually claimed that it would create about 90,000 jobs. But the most recent and realistic economic forecasts have shown that at least 800,000 Australian workers will lose their jobs in the next year. And actually, this is a figure from like a week ago, and I think it's actually been revised upwards since then. And, you know, unemployment is tipped to rise well above 9%. To seriously begin to offset the impact of the crisis, an injection of government spending on a massively greater scale would be necessary. And it's pretty obvious, if you think about it, where this money could go. Just for a start, the Rudd government could pay the unemployed, pensioners and students who currently live below the poverty line, you know, a full minimum wage so that they can live. Anyone who's ever used public transport or the public hospital system can attest for the sore need for spending on this essential infrastructure. But now that there's more daily indication of the devastating toll the recession will have and the need for more government spending, Treasurer Wayne Swan has been preparing the ground absolutely for a tough May budget. And Rudd's stimulus package represents a policy approach that also has a very limited shelf life. The bailout up until now has been wholeheartedly backed by the Australian bourgeoisie, from the Chamber of Commerce to individual capitalist swine and rabid anti-worker scum like Westfield boss Frank Lowy, who I have a very personal hatred for. There's a picture of him in the Business Review Weekly most recent. If you saw it, you'd understand why. Just so smug. And, you know, all of these bosses have clamoured for government action to restore confidence in their rotten system and to get the economy and their profits moving. But the government can't go on indefinitely producing bailout packages. For capitalism to get out of this crisis, workers' living standards will have to be savaged. And as the recession deepens here, the bosses will demand that Rudd launches substantial attacks on workers to force us to pay for the failure of their system. And because Rudd is so committed to saving that system, he's going to heed those demands. But there's no need to take my word for it or, you know, accept that I have, you know, once or twice in the past read tarot cards or anything like that and make any speculation about whether that helps me to make that prediction. Because Gillard's response, I think, to the signs of economic crisis is really telling. Earlier this year, when the Western Australian unions announced that they were going to push for wage increases, Gillard seized the opportunity to make the argument that wage increases would only contribute to unemployment. And she urged a message, you know, she really wanted to communicate a message of restraint in these difficult times to unionists. Of course, this message wasn't aimed at the mining bosses who've converted their millions into billions out of the resources boom of the past decade, but to workers who actually created those mega profits. Or take the example that we've heard a bit about this weekend, and if you've been reading the magazine, you will have heard of the over 1,800 workers who were sacked at Pacific Brand a month ago. Despite the fact that the Labor government actually been informed about the sackings there weeks before they were announced, they didn't pass on this information to workers or their unions. So essentially what they did was undermine any attempt to be able to defend these jobs. And when the sackings actually happened, rather than condemn CEO Sue Morfitt, who managed to triple her pay to almost $2 million whilst decrying the ailing status of the business and justifying the sackings, Gillard actually attacked another union, the MUA, for their decision to take action in solidarity with the sacked workers. They actually had wanted to impose union bans on Pacific Brands, and Gillard actually threatened the MUA with $750,000 worth of fines if they went ahead with it. So I think it's pretty clear that we have every indication of Labor's preparedness to attack workers in the crisis. In the lead-up to the 2007 federal election, Socialist Alternative not only recognised that Labor was running on one of its most anti-worker platforms ever, but warned in the November 07 edition of our magazine, and I'm reading a quote now, "Labor is just as determined to rule for the rich and powerful. Labor's industrial relations policy is simply work choices light. Some apologists for the ALP like to claim that Rudd is only saying these things to get elected, that once in government, Rudd will change his spots and back away from his right-wing policies. This is fantasy land stuff. The whole of the ALP leadership, not just Rudd, but also supposed left-wingers like Gillard and Lindsay Tanner, is totally committed to running capitalism for the bosses. We are going to have a fight on our hands under a Labor government." And this assessment was based on the reality that historically Labor has always ruled for the rich. But you can understand why, to a lot of people, this can seem like a contradiction, because after all, the Labor Party still, you know, occasionally professes itself to be on the side of working people or working families, as Rudd likes to call us. And I'm not a family, but... and it certainly looks to workers to get elected. So why is it the case that Labor governments have always ruled for the rich? And I want to spend some time going over this. The first thing to say is that this has everything to do with the nature of the Labor Party as a reformist party that seeks to win government in order to manage the capitalist system. And it has nothing to do with, as my family like to argue with me, the factionalised nature of the party, the control of the right, or any other reasons that are advanced by, you know, the kind of Labor Party true believers who still hold to the myth that, you know, once upon a time there was a more radical ALP, or, you know, a blind and utopian faith that, you know, the Reformist or Labourist project, which argues that society can be radically transformed in the interests of the working class if only we get, you know, these better leaders elected into Parliament in order to institute pro-worker reforms, you know, that this is clearly, you know, a myth. Not only has this project been thoroughly tried and failed, but it's, you know, a complete pipe dream. That's because despite the superficial veneer, the power begins and ends with who's in government. The Parliament has only limited powers. Under capitalism, real power, like the power to decide who gets hired, or in today's context of crisis, increasingly who gets fired, whether workers are going to be sent to kill and be killed in wars and so on, exists in the corporate boardrooms, within the state bureaucracy that makes policy, and this is without even mentioning the power of the army, police or courts, all of which are unelected bodies immune to even the most minute democratic accountability. And if you're a politician, you either have to submit to this reality or you're simply not going to get ahead. Just ask Whitlam, an example that probably many of you are familiar with. When his Labor government of the 1970s didn't attack unions and wages enough to satisfy the bosses, they launched an investment strike to hold the government to ransom. And then they did away with any veneer of democracy and they just sacked him. And they didn't just get rid of the government, they put the army on alert in order to put down any strikes from workers, you know, to actually reinstate him. So parties that have a focus on getting elected and running capitalism, like the ALP, will always end up modifying their policies to fit the demands of the people with power in capitalism, the bosses, irrespective of the interests of their working class support base. And Labor's work choices like policies and their assurances to the bosses that they'd be reasonable economic managers in the lead up to the Rudd election was a signal to big business of Labor's unwavering commitment to making Australian capitalism, you know, work as efficient as possible. And if that means attacking all of us, our rights and conditions, well, you know, so much the worse for us. And when in government, the record shows that Labor has always actually gotten worse, not better, with regards workers' rights and interests. You know, and sort of think of it in terms of as the pressure on them sort of increases in proportion with the proximity of them, you know, to all of the individual heads of business, you know, who are always around them and in their ears and so on, it tailors its policies more and more to the needs of the corporate world and the captains of industry, you know, because they're in the saddle now. They're doing the job of managing the system for them. And with what effect? Well, today, like I said earlier, we're witnessing a continuation of the Howard's policies under Rudd to steal Aboriginal land for corporate use, to bash unions and beat the war drum for US imperialism in Afghanistan. And what's more, in the current context of cutthroat competition between corporations in a system in crisis, the only way a reformist party like the ALP can really prove itself to business is by savagely attacking workers. And so I guess that whilst I've argued that, you know, it's the nature of the Labor Party as a reformist party, which means it will inevitably attack workers, that's really still no excuse for the situation that we've seen unfold over the past year, where the leadership of the trade unions, which is tied to and still has influence within the ALP, has been largely content to roll over and accept Rudd's right-wing anti-worker agenda. For anyone who's ever held the position that the Labor Party could be reformed from within or, you know, placed under pressure from the left, you know, including those who argued that we just needed to stop criticising Labor until we'd gotten rid of Howard, you know, in the lead up to the election, this grand bit of fiction has been unveiled by the disgraceful role of the union bureaucracy and the Labor left over the past, you know, year, but, you know, even before that, really, before Rudd got elected. Union leaders have refused to stand up to the government, allowing Rudd and Gillard to implement whatever noxious anti-worker policies they want. Before the elections, the trade union leadership engaged in the project that I think can only really be described as killing workers' mobilisations, and their argument went, all we need to do is get rid of Howard and then we can raise our criticisms, pressure Rudd to scrap all of work choices and so on. And this elect Labor approach to getting rid of work choices was captured in the following quote from Sharon Burrow, who was speaking in this instance at the Labor Day celebration in Brisbane in 2007. Some of you may have been at it. And she said, you don't have to strike. You just have to vote. One simple act of democracy to get rid of the IR laws. And this is, you know, a strategy, that quote captures a strategy that was both dishonest and completely demobilising. Even bureaucrats like John Robertson, who was the head of the Unions New South Wales, who claimed to have no illusions that Rudd would scrap all of the IR laws without pressure, he was content to leave this task until Rudd got elected, and he stated, "I'll be happy to sort of, you know, pull Kevin Rudd along once he's Prime Minister about what he does with the unions and the rest of the industrial relations policy and all those sorts of things." You can sort of tell by the tone that he's not particularly serious even in that quote. And now that we have a Labor government, none of this, you know, pulling along or pressuring has materialised at all. The union leader's complacence is even more damning when we reflect that there was never any indication in the lead-up to Rudd's election that he would do otherwise than maintain 90% of the IR laws. Ever since the ALP unveiled its Work Choices Light law in the form of the Fair Work Bill, the union bureaucracy has played the role of apologising for Labor. And that's, of course, only when they're not, you know, really busily sucking up to Rudd and Gillard. In March, Sharon Burrow lauded the passage of the Fair Work laws as a historic moment in restoring workers' rights and a state of affairs to take pride in. And the ACTU has been aided in its betrayal by former ACTU secretary, now Labor politician, Greg Combey. He rode into Parliament on the back of the Your Rights at Work campaign, and he's repaid Australian workers for their support by acting as Gillard's enforcer in the Parliament. He took took it upon himself to play the role of going around to every Labor Party MP and arguing to them that they had to support the Fair Work Bill, i.e. Work Choices Light. And he described the bill in Parliament as a tremendous victory for the Your Rights at Work campaign. Once disparaged by the bosses, Combe has now become the darling of figures like Heather Riddow, who's the head of the Bosses Union in Australia. And she was recently ebullient with praise for Combe. And his promotion, he's been promoted actually to business liaison on the emissions trading scheme. Yeah, and she said, "I love working with Combe. He's so great. He's been wonderful and pleasant." And that gives you an idea of what kind of a scumbag he is. And the Combe case, I think, moreover, really demonstrates how the union bureaucracy, you know, whose job it is to negotiate with and reach compromises with the bosses, you know, essentially make their peace with bosses' rule, are only too happy to sell out workers in the pursuit of their own ambitions and aspirations for a cushy, you know, secure job and the chance to hobnob it in higher social circles. Well, lower if you think of Heather Riddow, but, you know, not in their minds. But this sorry state of affairs that we're confronted with today wasn't this, you know, fait accompli. It's not like it had to be this way. Things could have been very different had the unions put up serious resistance to Labor's IR plans last year. Gillard could have been forced to back down on the back of protests and strikes. And after all, you think about it, it took only a couple of National Days of Action and the threat of future protests to get charges that had been laid by the ABCC against the CFMEU official Noel Washington dropped. In fact, had the unions backed up the Your Rights at Work campaign that had mobilised hundreds and thousands of workers with hard-hitting industrial action in 2005 to 2007, instead of waiting for Labor to get elected, Rudd and Gillard could never have gotten away with producing a carbon copy of Work Choices. And more importantly, it's likely that the IR laws would have been ripped up long before Rudd came into power. And there's been no pressure on Rudd from the Labor left in his caucus. When Labor left figures like Gillard or Jenny Macklin, who's, you know, presiding over the Northern Territory intervention, aren't leading the charge with attacks and, you know, turning themselves into the most right-wing elements in the Rudd government, they're providing cover for the government's right-wing policies. You know, with their snouts firmly ensconced in the parliamentary trough, the Labor left have acquired a taste for power and they're not going to let, you know, their working class base get in the way of it. None of them have even been vaguely critical of the continuation of Howard's policies under Rudd's Labor. And I think one example of this that sort of illustrates it is the Victorian deal that was brokered earlier this year, which shows that relations are at their closest in years between the so-called socialist left of the Labor Party and the hard right unity faction. This deal, for anyone who's not familiar with it, was essentially a pledge ensuring that the Labor right and Labor left factions would work together in the upcoming state and federal elections, and indicates that there is no sentiment whatever amongst the left to challenge the right in the party. And at the Socialist Left Conference that was called to approve the deal, one of the best attended in years, it's got to be said as well, had hundreds of people at it. Of the 400 people who attended, only 9 people, mostly rank-and-file members of the CFMEU, voted against this deal with the Labor right. And this is not just the case in Victoria. In New South Wales, the Labor left recently voted in a party caucus for electricity privatisation under the Premier Nathan Rees. And this decision takes place in the aftermath of events last year that saw previous Premier Yemma replaced by Rees when he ignored a Labor Party conference vote against power privatisation. And, you know, in that instance, the union leaders had decided that he'd gone too far. Well, actually, the Labor left in New South Wales are now backing further privatisation. It bears restating that Rudd and the government will attack workers in the recession. And the Labor left and the union leadership's strategy of deferring to Rudd has been and will continue to be utterly disastrous. It's only too obvious what sort of things the Labor left could be demanding if it was serious about challenging Rudd and supporting workers. Just for a start, you know, the millions of dollars that's already been meted out to banks, financial institutions and companies should be given to workers to pay off their mortgages. Jobs should be protected, and it should be made clear that no industry that receives even 1 cent of public funding should be able to sack any workers. That the billions of dollars being spent on defence and maintaining Australian troops in the Middle East should be spent on welfare, health and education. That workers' wages not be undermined, that all of the banks and failing industries should be nationalised and placed under the democratic control of the mass of workers, and that the rich and the corporations be massively taxed to raise funding for infrastructure and offset the impact of the crisis, that there be no sacrifices made by workers in the current context where bosses are still in this fantastic position. Actually, I have the, like I mentioned earlier, the Business Review Weekly, but in this edition that's its most recent, it's got a list, it's got the published the latest 200 rich list. And, of course, the cover says how the mighty have fallen, you know, as their kind of cover story. When you actually open it up, you find that 70 of the bosses on this list have actually increased their wealth since last year, and only 30 have taken any sort of pay cut at all. And I could go on about what, you know, the money could be used on. Confronted with increasingly grim forecasts of high unemployment and more misery to come in the crisis as Australia continues to be impacted by the recession, we need more demands and criticism of the rotten Labor Party's agenda, not less. And the ACTU has played a shameful role in demonstrating its total disinterest in voicing them. But even if the union leaders and the Labor left weren't so totally bankrupt, even if they were placing some demands on Labor, Rudd and Gillard would still be just as likely to do the ruling class's bidding and attack workers in today's recession. There is no realistic alternative for Labor to this, since they accept that their policy should be limited to what the capitalist class will find acceptable. And this time around, capitalism's not going to be rescued, as I've said, except through massive attacks on the working class. And while Rudd has been more than happy to lecture workers on the need for all of us to sacrifice, you know, and even to do things like fund a stimulus package, his newly found social democratic zeal isn't going to extend to infringing in any way on the right of the Australian bosses to make their profits. Under real pressure from the unions and mass working class mobilisation, Labor might have been forced to back down from some of its attacks of the past year. But if we're going to win the changes that we really need and stand any hope of stemming the tide of mass sackings, home repossessions and cuts to essential services to come, we're going to have to build a broad fight back that challenges the Labor Party and its pro-business agenda all the way down the line. And that means, put simply, the kind of resistance that we've seen from workers in Europe, from France to Ireland to Greece to Italy, who've set the example of mass protests and strikes and the occupations of workplace and all of the wonderful things that we've heard over the course of the conference, wonderful instances of workers' resistance. By his own admission, Rudd has no problem with capitalism, just extreme capitalism, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean, because capitalism today isn't doing anything extraordinary or extraneous. Crisis is part and parcel of an anarchic capitalist system that's based solely on the rapacious drive for profits at the top of society and the exploitation of the working class. And this is exactly why all of the horror and misery of this current economic crisis, and, you know, that's already been unleashed and that we're going to continue to see in increasing, depth in Australia, really poses the necessity to go beyond this sick and destructive profit-driven system. If we want fundamental change, we're going to have to get rid of capitalism. And only a genuine mass party of and for workers, you know, a socialist alternative to the Labor Party, with the politics and knowledge of past class struggles, experience in standing up to the bosses, that can actually be, will actually be the party that can challenge bosses' rule and the whole of the rotten system. And that's only the kind of party that's going to be fit to lead the struggles that we need to wage in the future. And this is the kind of party that so sorely needs to be built in Australia today.